Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When business thinker Clayton Christensen put the phrase disruptive innovation on the table in the 1990s, the world pounced on it. It seemed to capture exactly what was going on with the disruptive emergence of the Internet. The decades since have seemed all about disruption on many fronts. This hour on Point, Clayton Christensen on his latest thinking on disruption and where it lands. He's still thinking it through. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me now in the studio is Clay Christensen, professor at Harvard Business School, author in 1997 of the bellwether book The Innovator's Dilemma. His latest book just out is Competing Against Luck, the story of innovation and customer choice. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Clayton Christensen, welcome back to On Point. Good to see you here.
Great to see you, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
Disruption is the word that you put on the table in a big way, disruptive innovation, the innovator's dilemma. And disruption itself seems to become the theme of the decade since. I want to dig into your latest thinking on this, but just think with us for a minute about, are we in a more disrupted world, a more disruptive world than our predecessors were? Certainly the language of our times is all wrapped around this word.
To some degree, it is more pervasive than ever before. And that is, there are two types of architectures in an enterprise. And one type of architecture is modular. And so you take all of the pieces of the system and you just put together, and like Dell Computer was a modular architecture, and you could be very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Samsung has an architecture that is modular. They can just take components and slip them together and every few months come up with something.
Not working so great right now, bursting into flames.
No kidding. Then the other architecture is interdependent. That means if you change one piece of the system, you have to change many other pieces of the system. And to do anything, you have to do everything. And so Apple is slow in their new product development because their architecture is interdependent. And yet you need to think mm-hmm. about, if I change this, what else needs to change? And over the last 30 years, more and more products are modular in character. And therefore, it's easier and faster to innovate in many industries than ever before. And so it appears as if disruption is accelerating. But that's the cause.
Does this metaphor extend? We'll be all about business, all over business in this hour, but does this metaphor extend beyond the realm of enterprises and business? I mean, this word disruption, you know, look at our politics. We're in the middle of a very disruptive season of American politics. And one of the main issues on the stump is the economy, how thoroughly and deeply and widely disrupted that has been. We've seen social disruption. We've seen demographic disruption. I mean, people may social norm disruption. A lot of this is embraced. Mm-hmm. A lot of this is upsetting for others. At that meta level, are we in a more disruptive time?
I think that that's right. You know, so much of the phenomena that we observed in our research about what causes, why is it so hard to sustain success, is in the business model itself gets turned upside down. And it's in the business model changing. We see that everywhere. You see it in religion. You see it in the way an election occurs.
Religion has a business model? Politics have a business model?
Yeah. That is what we need to do in order to get the result that customers need. And this is the way we make – everybody has to make money to survive. And the profit formula by which people, organizations make their money is the profit form – is the business model. And WBUR has a business model.
Our home station here.
Yeah.
But a religion, politics?
Yeah.
Are we talking there about what brings in donations from donors or something else? Yeah, or results that in politics is the result, of a strong country, the profit measure?
Well, so in a religion, people go there because they want to understand the purpose of life, mm-hmm. and an element of it is where do they get their donations from?
Yeah.
But the big question is, what motivates people to prioritize religion or deprioritize religion in their lives?
Mm-hmm.
And the religions in America, except for a few, are just losing the formula, And fewer and fewer people, especially in the next generation, see any religion. They don't see a motivation.
Because they're losing it because they're not satisfying a need?
Or? That's right. That's right. And that's what we wrote the book about, actually, was what is it that causes people to buy this product and ignore that one?
Well, how is it that a business or a religion or politics can satisfy a need in one era and then in another era not satisfy?
Well, that's the theme of the book actually is around this point, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I might find myself in this position. And when I find myself in this position, what should I do to be successful?
When your politics or your religion, or most to the point of your book, your business, isn't satisfying your customer any longer?
That's right. But in this other situation, people need a different job that they have to get done. And so what we tried to do in the mm-hmm. book is to operate, to propose that rather than understanding the customer, what you need to understand are, what are the jobs that arise in people's lives that cause them to buy a product or a service? Can I give you an example, mm-hmm. Tom?
Yes, please.
So a number of years ago, one of the big fast food restaurant chains in America was trying to increase the sales of their milkshakes.
Okay.
And the way they had always thought about marketing was, we need to understand the customer. And these are very sophisticated marketing people.
You mean like, do they like vanilla or chocolate, or do they like it thick or not so thick? Or
absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd get very, very clear feedback from their customers about how they should improve the product, which mm-hmm. they did. And the impact on sales was negligible.
Hmm.
So we decided that we at schools like Harvard had framed the problem incorrectly. And the question is, there must be something that arises in people's lives on occasion that causes them to go out and hire a milkshake to do the job.
Hire a milkshake.
Yeah. And I need to understand what's the job.
Hire a vet, I get. Hire a milkshake?
That's right. So one of our colleagues stood in a restaurant for 18 hours one day mm-hmm. and just took very careful notes on what time did they buy the milkshake, what were they wearing, did they buy other food with the milkshake, did they eat it in the restaurant, or did they get in the car and go off with it?
Mm-hmm.
And about half of the milkshakes were sold before 8:30 in the morning.
That's awful early for that big cup of sweets.
That's right.
But okay.
It was the only thing they bought. They were always alone, mm-hmm. and they always got in the car and drove off with it. So the next day, we returned and positioned ourselves outside the restaurant so that we could confront these customers as they emerged with their milkshake at hand
mm-hmm.
and ask them in language that they could understand, I got a real problem you got to help me with.
Mm-hmm.
What job arose in your life that caused you to come here and hire this milkshake at 6:30 in the morning? And as they would struggle to answer the program, we'd try to help them by asking, well, look, think about the last time you had the same job to do, but you didn't come here to hire the milkshake.
Is this prompting a witness toward the thesis, Professor Christensen? But the job's out there. What do they say?
Yeah, so What the last time you were in the same situation, but you didn't come here to hire the milkshake, what did you hire? And it turned out that they all had the same job to do. That is, they had a long and boring drive to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed something to do while they were driving to stay engaged with life. One hand had to be on the wheel.
Yep.
But gosh, they gave me another hand and there's nothing in it. And I'm not hungry yet, but I know that I'll be hungry by 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So I just need something that will just thunk down and sit in my stomach for the morning. And
the milkshake will keep them company. It will fill that need. It will do that job in your sense.
And we asked, well, think about the last time you were in the same situation, but you didn't hire a milkshake. What did you hire? And one guy said, you know, I hired a banana last Friday. Take my word for it, never hire bananas.
They're gone. It's gone too quick. Then the peel is stinking in the seat next to you.
Absolutely, you know. And another guy said, I hired donuts to do the job, but I can't take one, you know, and I need to lose weight.
Yeah.
And I've got to, sometimes I hire bagels to do the job, but they're so dry and tasteless, you know, and then I have to steer the car with my knees while I put the
cream cheese on. That's a danger. Identify a job to be done, and you may be able to innovate to fill it. You say this is the path for businesses that want to successfully innovate. I want to push whether or not it may be the path for nations, societies as well. We'll look at both. Is this still about disruptive innovation?
It's about the job to be done, which is the other side of disruption. And so disruption gives you a theory about what causes successful companies to fail. Why do they not do things? And the job to be done is, well, do I just not do anything? Could you give us some guidance about how to succeed in what you're doing so that you can be successful?
Boy, in politics, in business, in our society, we could stand to keep our eye on that target. Clay Christensen's new book is Competing Against Luck, The Story of Innovation and Customer Choice. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about disruption and innovation in business, in society, with the man who coined the phrase disruptive innovation 20 years ago and has been wrestling with it ever since. Clayton Christensen is with us, professor at Harvard Business School, author of the new book, Competing Against Luck, The Story of Innovation and Customer Choice. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us today. How are you feeling about our age of disruption? Is disruptive innovation working for you? Is it exciting, necessary, thrilling, painful? Do you see the future belonging to those who take on jobs to be done, unmet needs, desires, necessities? Interesting. Lots of questions coming for you online, Clay. Brad writes to us, says, disruptive innovation is sexy. It dominates the allocation of capital. But incremental innovation represents most of the innovation that occurs, Brad asserts. It enables breakthroughs, delivers better long-term results if it's valued. He says, I feel that disruptive innovation bias has negative impacts on workers. Metal, you know, grinders aren't valued, factory workers, and our politics, Brad says. Polarizing, sweeping change is idealized rather than the more cohesive process of incrementally, quote-unquote, perfecting the union. Can Mr. Christensen discuss?
That's a great observation. One of the things we observed is that there are three types of innovation. And the first type of innovation are efficiency innovations that allow us to do more with less. And the people who win that game are the established, the incumbent leaders in an industry or an enterprise. The second type of innovations are sustaining innovations, which our listener refers to. And sustaining innovations make good products better.
This would be like going from Apple 4 to 5 to 6 to 7, or
that's
that
right.
Sort of thing.
And they're very critical. But they don't create dramatic change by their very nature. And the third type of innovation are disruptive innovations. And to some degree, we made a mistake when we called it disruption because disruption has so many connotations in the English language.
Well, but aren't the connotations that you and the world more or less embraced here? Like,
that's right.
But, I mean, you
but
know,
there's a more
turn over the apple cart a little bit, do something radically new.
Yeah, but that's not what we meant. And what we think of in disruptive innovation is very specifically, it's an innovation that transforms a product or service that historically were so complicated and expensive that only the rich had access to it. Disruptive innovation makes it so much more affordable and accessible that many more people who historically didn't have access to it now do.
Okay.
And
but it still involves breaking some eggs.
That's right. You absolutely have to do it, and the business model is typically what has to change in order to deliver to the product a service at a different price point that is simple and affordable. And just a few examples, the Model T from Henry Ford was a disruptive innovation. It transformed a product that was viewed as a toy for the rich.
Mm-hmm. Fancy first cars. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And by making it affordable, millions of people in America had able to own it. And that meant that Ford had to hire more people to make it and distribute it and sell it and service it. And it transformed the world. But that the mechanism was making it affordable and accessible.
Is there a political parallel of that, the introduction of that product, in terms of ideas or political approaches?
Well, I've thought about this a lot. And I think one of the things that's going on, Tom, in our world was highlighted to me a number of years ago when we met a gentleman who was a Marxist economist from China.
Okay.
And he came here.
Those must be kind of rare there these days.
That's right.
Got a lot of market working there.
And he got a Fulbright scholarship to come to Boston to study democracy and capitalism of all of the strange topics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we got to know the man quite well during his year with us. And before he left for home, we invited him to dinner. And I asked him, so of all the things that you learned about democracy while you were in America, was there anything that really surprised you? And he said, absolutely. I had no idea how critical religion is to the functioning of democracy. And I'd never put these things together before, but it's just like this guy parachutes in from Mars, and that's what he sees.
Seemed right for a while. Is it still right? I mean, we've got a lot of people. Yeah. I don't know if they're really putting religion first when they go for Donald Trump. I don't know.
It's more critical now than ever before. Uh-huh. And what he said was, democracy wasn't organized so that the government can keep track of what everybody does.
China style. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But rather, democracy works because most people, most of the time, voluntarily choose to obey the law.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taught when they were younger at churches that they should voluntarily choose to follow the rules because even if the police don't catch you, God will hold you accountable.
So a kind of glue working there, as this visitor from China saw it.
That's right.
In the U.S.
And in America, as religions lose their traction with most people, we just can't hire enough police to make democracy work, you know. And you see in the chaos that we see surrounding us today, what's the causal mechanism of this? And that is people don't know instinctively how individually they need to change their behavior so that democracy still works. And it's a big deal.
People want change there. Businesses want and have to change. Politics have seen a big call for change lately. Clayton Christensen is with us. His new book is Competing Against Luck. We'll look more at his theory of how this works. We get a lot of callers for you. Let's go right to the western U.S., Washington State, Tenasket. Yannicka is on the air. Yannicka, you're on with Clay Christensen.
Thank you. Hi, Tom. I have a question for Dr. Christensen. I assume he's a doctor somewhere. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that Bernie Sanders' deeply thought-out plan for disruption lost out to Donald Trump's chaotic plan, if you can call it a plan at all?
Well, if I could use the language from the research competing against luck, you know, what we're trying to understand is what situation do people find themselves in that causes them to pull something into their lives? And there is just in America a deep, deep and broad felt sense that the world is not fair. I just feel screwed every day. The government is dishonest. The elections are dishonest. My employer isn't treating me as I should. They don't give me opportunities. And
you might feel that and vote for Bernie Sanders. You might feel that and vote for Donald Trump. And Yannicka asks, why do you think the Trump alternative fared better here?
It's just because they both have the people who voted for those two had exactly the same job to do.
I.e.?
That is, I just am so frustrated with life. I need to just vent. And it's not so much that I need to have a solution. I'm just angry at the world. And so if I'm a Democrat, I can vote for Sanders to get that job done. Or if I'm a Republican, I could vote for Trump to get. But both of them are selling the very same thing, which is, I'm one of you. I feel screwed too. I'm angry.
But Yannicka's trying to find the distinction. They both appeal to unsatisfied customers, if you will, citizens, voters.
Yeah.
But Bernie was much more programmatic in the way he talked about change.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is perhaps more visceral in the way he talks about change. I mean, he's
That's
got,
probably right.
So why would one win the customer, the voter, over the other in that context?
I don't know. Yeah, a simple vote explanation might be that Bernie is a socialist, and there are just not as many socialists out there as there are people who don't have jobs and are in the Midwest and you know, come from a different background. But I don't know. It's a good question.
Yannicka, I appreciate your call. Where do you see the pace of innovation being good in this country now? Where do you see it, or in what industries? Where do you see it flagging? Who understands the kind of lessons that you propose as the way here? Who doesn't?
Boy, it's everywhere when you see it. But one of the places where it is accelerated and needs to accelerate even more is in education. So the university's costs are accelerating at a faster rate than healthcare costs in America. And the government's position on the accelerating of costs has been, well, we have to make it so that everybody can afford higher education. And this is a key element of what Obama has been asking for. So the question is, how can people afford higher education? They don't ask the right question, which is, how could you make higher education affordable? And online learning is a very important element of that, you know. And so a good example of what can be done is just north of Boston, there's a organization called Southern New Hampshire University. And historically, they had 3,000 students, you know, a campus that wasn't extraordinary in any way. And year after year, they barely made enough money to stay in business. And then Paul LeBlanc, who is the current president, realized there are two jobs needing to get done out there that people find themselves in. And one situation is, I just turned 18. I graduated from high school. I need to leave. I need to get
out in the world.
That's right. And show the world that I'm an adult. And the traditional university does that job reasonably well. But there's another job that arises in the lives of people who are 35 years old, three children. They can't get a good job because they didn't apply themselves when they were in high school. And I need a better job, but I can't go to some stupid university.
It's going
to
leave me $100,000, $200,000 in debt.
That's right, you mm-hmm. know. But I'd like to be able to I actually don't even need a degree. I need a certification
mm-hmm.
or you know, they need to recognize that I've learned something mm-hmm. as an adult, you know. And that when you have that job to do, holy cow, online learning is exactly the right thing to hire to get that job done. And Southern New Hampshire, oh my gosh. Over the course of the last 10 years, they've gone from 3,000 to over 100,000 students.
Mm-hmm.
They had to separate it out because mm-hmm. the two jobs are very different, you mm-hmm. know. And their revenue is about $500 million a year, very profitable.
Lessons there for education, maybe for business well beyond that, maybe for politics well beyond that. Janet in Montreal, Canada, you're on with Clay Christensen. Thank you for calling, Janet. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just calling because it often runs through my mind about the idea of how they want to bring in robots. And I just find that interesting in terms of defining what the job is that needs to be done. And I don't mean literally the word job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yep.
In the sense your guess is defining it. So I find it, I guess it's kind of a question more than a comment. I just wonder about how they define the job that needs to be done, because it seems to me that it's putting things backwards. Like the job to me that needs to be done is people need to work and live, and therefore they need jobs, not we need to have businesses and whatever, and people are just kind of like this accidental thing happening on the sideline.
Yes. I'm really glad you raised that, Janet. What about it, Clay?
Yeah, Janet, that is a great question. I need to give my answer by giving you another illustration, and then let's bring it back. There is a movement in the United States to try to make healthcare more affordable and accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And you've really got two options. One option is to just hope that the doctors will take pay cuts.
Okay.
The other option is, could we bring technology to a nurse so that the nurse can do more and more of the things that historically had to be done by a doctor? And these are diagnostics and equipment
mm-hmm.
that allow a nurse to look inside your arm to see mm-hmm. if you've broken anything.
What's going on there?
You know?
Okay.
Or do I really have strep throat? And, you know, things that are at the simple end of the spectrum of things that the doctor could do.
Yeah.
Bring technology so that a nurse could do that. And then, what else could technology occur that allowed a nurse to do more and more and more sophisticated things by using technology that bring rules to that endeavor?
But what about the robot that puts people out of work, makes more money for the company because it's more efficient, but may not end up with the job to be done? Janet says, you know, happier.
Yeah, no. So what this entails for a robot
mm-hmm.
is at the very beginning, the robot can only do the simplest of the things that historically had required the judgment of a worker.
Mm-hmm.
And then the technology allows the robot to do more and more and more sophisticated things, okay? And you could say that that's a it turns upside down the worker. But a better way to frame it is, oh my gosh, the simplest stuff, I don't have to do that anymore. I can do more sophisticated things that the rules are not yet clear for the robot. And so if we frame it right, and especially if managers would frame it right, it enables their workers to do more and more sophisticated things, as opposed to we need to keep the workers chained to repeated work that is boring and
great in theory. In practice, people looking with some skepticism at what humans are going to do. Clay Christensen's new book is Competing Against Luck, The Story of Innovation and Customer Choice. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
We're talking this hour about disruption, innovation in business and society with the man who coined the phrase disruptive innovation 20 years ago. He's been wrestling with it ever since. He's thinking these days about what brings innovation. His latest book is Competing Against Luck, The Story of Innovation and Customer Choice. Clayton Christensen is my guest. You can join us this hour. What's your prime example of disruptive innovation? What's your question on how we fold the old, create the new? What's the unmet job to be done that you'd most like to see taken on these days? In the course of these last years, a couple of years ago, one of your colleagues at Harvard had a big critique of the whole idea of disruptive innovation. Jill Lepore, the big piece in The New Yorker, everybody was talking about it for a while. They're saying, well, look, this may not be the unalloyed good that it's been presented as. And by the way, there's all kinds of innovation that goes on outside this sort of terminology, this framework. Pretty critical take on that framing of the world of change. Has that factored into the way, to your continued thinking about this over the years, over the last couple of years, Clay?
Great question, Tom. As I've thought about, am I on the right track and trying to help people, there are two types of criticisms that kind of come at me.
Mm-hmm.
And one are, occasionally there is somebody like Professor Lepore at Harvard who wrote a very critical book, and she never read the book.
You a critical article about
me.
Yeah.
And the book, The Innovator's Dilemma. And she never even read the book.
You sure?
I'm certain, because there are keys in anything that you write that you can tell have they actually read it or not.
Okay. I mean, I don't know, but yet she made a deep critique that when you read it, you know, you thought, well, maybe.
Yeah.
Because your thesis has been so widely accepted that it seems
That's
like
right.
anything that gets that much currency deserves to be given serious treatment.
That's right. And that's where I want to go next.
Mm-hmm.
So for her, the fact that she would pretend as if she was going against something that were windmills, you know.
Well, I mean,
but the
whole idea got so much currency in society, even if you hadn't read it, and I don't know that she didn't, but you could almost just look around and see how it had been adopted, how it had been absorbed.
That's right. And that's the other type of innovation, of
critique.
Critique.
Mm-hmm.
That is, Clay, it doesn't account for this, or it's being applied in the wrong way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And those are very helpful,
mm-hmm.
very helpful, because never does a theory emerge perfect, but rather whether it succeeds or not depends upon people taking the time to read it and then connecting with me or my colleagues and say, this doesn't work.
There's all kinds of ways of connecting. That's one. Where did it turn your attention if you were looking to examine further? What questions has that contemplation raised for you?
So for me, the most productive source are my students.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Harvard Business School, we teach by the case method. And I assign them every class, you've got to read this theory about mm-hmm. management, And then I want you to come prepared to tell Clay what's wrong with the theory.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, they've taught me a lot about what the theory could not explain.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some cases, we have had to change the theory to make it more clear.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, we've had to put a boundary around it and say, on this side, it seemed to work very well. On that other side of the boundary, don't use it because it doesn't apply. And I think that the fact that 25 years down after we published mm-hmm. the first piece, the reason why it has so much traction is because we actively have tried to get anomalies that we can't yet explain. And as a consequence, it's a living organism.
Do you think we've come to fetishize disruption, even innovation in our country lately, or are we falling short on that front? You've got the Peter Thiel critique that says we're not fundamentally innovating as we need to in this country.
Yeah. For me, it has never bothered me that people want to change. You know,
I mean, history is about change.
That's right. And historically, I think there are a lot of people who didn't want to change things because whatever, you know.
Well, but some of the whatever could be constants like, I don't know, ethics, morality. There are also, I think, ideally, some things that do sustain.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's right. I go back to my friend's observation about the link between religion and democracy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there got to be some fundamental things that has to be unchangeable that have been tested over time, that until we have another way. But even that, I'm just thinking out loud,
mm-hmm.
you want to be sure that what were rules that applied historically, will we find ourselves in a different situation in the future that requires that we change that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's a good observation.
Bob in Saco, Maine. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
The question I would like to make and to get an understanding of, in the capitalistic world where this technology gets developed and we become dependent on this technology, what kind of structure would be in place to hold down the cost? And after the rising cost of the product and the technology hits the ceiling, usually companies will start to lower their quality of product to further increase profit margins. How do we deal with things that are so critical, such as medical robots and technology and software that maybe have malware in there that could put a person at risk? How do we control the cost and the quality of these products?
Bob, is that an issue in your own working life, in your own industry, or your world?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I do suffer from product changes without me knowing it in my field of business.
You mean the companies just change a product and you don't know about it and it causes you problems because you see a diminution in quality?
Well, what they do is they change the manufacturer that is putting the product in my box, and sometimes the quality is lower, and it's all about the idea of increasing profits. And we know, we'll look at the EpiPen. We'll look at the increase in the price of the EpiPen and all the furor over that. Who's to say something like that is not going to happen in the robotics world as well?
Clay?
It's a good way to frame what's going on here, and I hope that it will bring you some ease or comfort. Go back in the history of computing. The first type of computer we had was a mainframe computer, and it cost $2 million.
Mm.
Very complicated. It filled the whole room, and the only people who could own and use a computer were large corporations and large universities. And then the personal computer reduced the cost from $2 million to $2,000. And they were much simpler products so that the average person could now own and use a computer. And it wasn't just the price, but the simplicity made it so that millions and millions more could use it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning, the technology, the kinds of things that it could do were very simple, like you could do spreadsheets and type. But then the technology made the personal computer better and better and better, so that plain old ordinary people like you and I could do more and more sophisticated things. Mm-hmm. And then the smartphone emerged, and it reduced the cost of a computer from 2,000 to 200, so that billions of people have access to it. And you look at just in the last few years, what you could do on that little smartphone are more sophisticated problems than people who used a mainframe a generation ago, you know. And so that's the way it has to work, and it benefits so many more people. But the pattern is very clear. You don't change the world by attacking the incumbents. You come in at the bottom of the market with a simple product and then make it more affordable and accessible. And so what you see today isn't what you'll see tomorrow.
And what do you say to someone like Bob, who's at the end of a chain that does not look to him like it's increasing quality and it's maybe more expensive? But
yeah,
the changes are not leading. It's not a kind of a, you know, noble escalator that he's looking at.
That's right. So what the kind of innovations that he is looking at, we call sustaining innovations that make good products better. And every company has to do that or they'll die.
But he's finding degradation of quality in spite of higher cost.
That's because in his industry, whatever it is, somebody hasn't disrupted it. So they're trying to
squeeze,
come down to a price point.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, what they need to do is come underneath that point and then go up. And if he doesn't see that in his industry, then shame on him. He needs to start a company to do it. And we have a lot of capital just sitting at the sidelines waiting for people like our caller to be an innovator.
Sam in Concord, Massachusetts. Sam, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Great discussion. I was just wondering where sustainability figures into all this. When I hear discussions like this, especially with people with a background in economics, my concern is, with sustainability of the planet, and also with corporations who really their only reason for being is to make profit for its shareholders. And I wonder where the idea of sustainability figures in. And also, you know, how do we, what would be the disruptive change that would disrupt the power that corporations have, so that instead of making an endless stream of products, we have to start paying attention to our own survival?
Sam, I appreciate your call. Clay Christensen, what if the job that we want done is a healthy, environmentally healthy planet? How do you get that to translate down into products and corporate operations that would support that?
Yeah. Again, a great question. Let me just offer an observation about one element of that, and that would be electric cars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a company in the West Coast called Tesla, and they make an electric car.
Sure.
It costs about $100,000. You got to be a rich person in order to have access to it. But, you know, it's clean, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so should we all hope to get Teslas? I don't think that works. But instead, you need to go to Beijing and just walk up and down the street, and about every 10th car is an electric car. And it's not the kind of car that could compete against BMW and Mercedes, but rather it's so cheap, it costs $3,000 to buy one.
Mm.
And it's narrow, and so I can't have a passenger unless I fold them up and put them in the back seat, you know. But because it's affordable and accessible, many people who were using things that pollute the environment, now it's clean.
But in Beijing, you can barely breathe. The air is so bad. What if we need this job to be done more quickly? I mean, I get the direction that's going, but what if the pace of filling this job, healthy planet, is not sufficient to save the planet?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. It truly is a huge problem, because in other industries, when you start something at the bottom mm-hmm. and then move up, mm-hmm. It works. But if you can't do at the bottom of the market and you have to go in head-on competition with the traditional way of doing it, the old approach mm-hmm. almost always wins.
So is there some structural impediment in this country, globally, to bringing on environmentally friendly products from the bottom, as you say?
Well, you answer your own question. So let me propose it to, I'm speaking to the mm-hmm. the caller.
Caller. Mm-hmm.
You could use wind to provide electricity, and it's very clean. Mm-hmm. And so we organized our life to have wind. And then what happens when the wind stops? What are you going to do? You know? And so
sun, tide, something else?
Yeah. But we, as users mm-hmm. of electricity, mm-hmm. we actually don't allow electricity to just go off.
Mm-hmm.
And then unpredictably come on again halfway and then go off and then come. We demand performance,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that means that something that is simple at the low end, not very good at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
we have to figure out a way to make it better. We are the ones that demand perfection.
So the job we want done may not be answerable by early products in that realm.
That's right, and so the problem is us, and that is a big problem, you know. Now, the illustration I did with electric cars in Beijing, it clean cars is doable because there is a lot of people whose option was no car at all,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
but when you bring unpredictable power to people who demand predictability,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's a very hard thing. We can hope for that forever, that just overnight our environment will become clean. But we have to just do that while we look in the mirror and say, this is a big problem.
Think of the job to be done, the whole job to be done, and expectations right there. Clayton Christensen writes about it in his new book, Competing Against Luck, The Story of Innovation and Customer Choice. Professor Christensen, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for joining us. You're a good man.
It's good to have you.
I enjoyed listening to your questions.
This is On Point.